I'm supposed to tell you my name, first of all. I'm Walter Bowman, and I teach at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus. That's the commercial. And what we're doing this week is a session, or a series of sessions, called The Lessons of Barman. But I want to... I brought along some new jokes this time for Holden, and I want to share above all today a few headlines that were assembled by the Columbia Journalism Review, and the title of their book is called Squad Helps Dog Bite Victim, and there's some wonderful stuff in here. One of my favorites, I'll tell you when to laugh, all right? One of my favorites is, crash prompts change in rules. Planes must clear mountains first. Oh, that's wonderful. Then war dims hopes for peace. What else? Milk drinkers turn to powder. We'll put that up here and hold it. Fish and game to hold elections. let's see. Oh, yes. This one comes from Seattle. Obituaries. Many persons died this week in and near Seattle. That accounts for the large number of obituaries appearing in this morning's Post Intelligencer. Are they still publishing that in Seattle?
Yes, they are.
Oh, if they do so with such intelligence, I won't subscribe. All right. We're talking about the lessons of barman. Today I want to talk about the church as critic, or another way of saying it would be the church under communism. Now, I want to give you a few disclaimers, first of all, because this is a grandiose title, The Church Under Communism. I think the first thing to be said is that there are many churches under communism. And I don't know, or I don't have much first-hand knowledge about very many of them at all. One would have to talk, for example, about the Catholic Church in Vietnam as one church under communism. We'd have to talk about the church in China. Dan and Karen were there. When were you there, Dan?
Last September.
Did you have contact with the churches in China?
Yeah, the whole trip was to visit the Protestant church.
Uh-huh. Maybe when I finish with this, you can say just a few things about that, about the church in communist China. There is obviously the church most in the news for all of us, and that is the Catholic Church in Poland. There are Lutheran churches in Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia. The Lutheran World Federation established contact with some Lutherans in Siberia after decades of non-contact. I don't know very much about that. There is the church in Russia that one would have to talk about, and their role in the World Council of Churches, which has led to a lot of problems. So, To simply say the church under communism is to say more than I can talk about this morning. And also, I think we have to understand that there are widely different forms of communism in the world today. Chinese communism is not identical with Russian communism. And as we discovered in East Germany, Russian communism is not identical with East German communism. And none of them are fully identical with Castro's kind of communism. So, again, to say the church under communism is really to say too much. I want to limit myself to the Lutheran churches in Eastern Germany right now, or in the German Democratic Republic. That's what we'll talk about. But I think it is instructive. Last November, on the Sunday after Luther's birthday, the Archbishop of Canterbury preached in Dresden, in the great Kreuzkirche there, the magnificent rebuilt large Lutheran church in Dresden. And it was a very, very moving occasion. At the same time, the Synod of the Church of England was meeting, and the Archbishop of Canterbury should have opened that synod with an address. Instead, he had a printed statement, which was read in his absence because he was in Dresden, and I received a copy of that statement at the late December meeting of the National Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue. It was an address to, now remember, to the Church of England was the address, and it's usually one of those sort of State of the Church addresses. But the Archbishop of Canterbury devoted the entire address to the relationship of the English Church to the Lutheran churches of Germany, and most particularly to the Lutheran churches of East Germany. And he said one thing that stuck in my mind. He said, the Lutheran Christians, our brothers and sisters in East Germany, are going to a hard school on behalf of all of us. We must learn with them. That's a marvelous statement. I mean, the whole address was deeply appreciative of Luther, of Lutheranism, but that particular sentence, our brothers and sisters in East Germany are going to a hard school on behalf of all of us, we must learn with them. That's the theme for what I want to do today. Summary. Barman, you remember, was the dramatic synod of the confessing church in Germany, May 29 to 31, 1934. It was in this century the most dramatic instance of church resistance to a totalitarian power. 138 delegates issuing a stirring confession. I read the centerpiece of it yesterday, against the Nazi regime, against Adolf Hitler, and above all against German Christianity. Hermann Sasse, probably the most Lutheran of this century, said the issue was Germanism or Christianity. Germanism or Christianity. That is such a powerful statement because it raises the question of Christianity and every kind of nationalism, also our own. I mean, we are not directly in a situation where we have to choose between Americanism and Christianity, but Sasse said that was the issue at that time. I want to raise the issue for us tomorrow when I try to talk about the churches under Western democracy. But let's look at it for just a moment once again in review. This is what I did yesterday. German Christians, Deutsches Christentum, stood for an oversimplified religiosity with Christian overtones. It was nationalistic, authoritarian, and personality cultic. It was racist, anti-Semitic. Even some of the most sober Lutheran theologians in Germany at that time issued a statement to Jewish Christians. Remember, there were 300,000 of them in Germany in 1933. 40% of the Jewish population of Germany was Christian, most of them Protestant, and these Lutherans in Erlangen said in an appeal to Jewish Christians, don't seek ordination to the ministry at this time. I mean, that was a dreadful concession. You see, it was a sellout. What else can you say? Some of you who were at the Barman conference told me this morning that among the things that the people there confessed, or at least that Eberhard Bethke confessed, was the slowness of the church to recognize the seriousness of the Jewish situation. Again, the parallel for me is how long it took the Christian church in this country to come to terms with our relationship to blacks. Or to go further, to Native Americans, to Indians, or to the internment of the Japanese in World War II. Where did you ever hear about this? Or, I think again, well, one could go on, but the racist dimensions of the Deutsches Christentum, It was anti-communist, it was anti-liberal, but, says Bethke in one of his books, very able to use democratic means for anti-democratic ends. I think about that every time I think of the attempts of some religious groups in this country to legislate certain dimensions of their own views, creationism, for example, using all the democratic processes for something which may finally be not compatible with a pluralistic society. The Deutsche Christen emphasized trust in God and human decency. That was what they meant by faith. See, every time somebody holds up a coin and says, oh, this country is built on religious principles, because there it is on our coin, in God we trust, you have to say, yes, but that may not be identical with Christianity. I'll say more about that again tomorrow. They emphasize trust in God and human decency. The first article as the giving of divine order to the world, and therefore we have to pay attention to race and nation and blood and so on. And they emphasize the third article as redemption through historical process. Hitler was riding the wave of the future. And they taught the second article of the creed as the gift of a kind of otherworldly salvation, which did not, in the last analysis, affect their functioning in this world. Barman said a radical no to all of these ideas, and a radical yes to Jesus the Christ, to a Christological theology, and to Christ's way of being in the world. In the name of Jesus' way of being leader by serving, they opposed the Führer Prinzip in church and state of leadership by power and by fiat. Now I think today what I want to do then is to look at the fate of Nazism, very briefly, we can just take a quick look at that, and then go on to what the defeat of Nazism in 1945 meant for Christianity in East Germany, because it was quite formative, and we'll see that in a moment. Hitler consolidated, I mean, remember Barman happened in 1934, May of 1934. Hitler rapidly consolidated his hold on Germany in a series of dramatic moves that reached their consummation in the Munich Agreement of 1938. Our guide of last year, who lives in Munich, Henry Kuhlmann, a 75-year-old romantic who had gone through all the Nazi period, pointed out the building and the balcony from which the Munich Pact was waived. But let me just trace these very quickly. June 30th to July 1st, there was the purge in which Hitler purged his own supporters as well as a number of other enemies, some of them quite personal. And in a dramatic statement to the German nation, he said, in a crisis, I alone am prosecutor, judge, and executioner. And everybody said, of course. You know? I mean, one has to see here how the erosion of constitutional forms was finally consummated in that moment when Hitler simply had, estimates range from 1,000 to 5,000 people, simply arrested and shot. And that was the end of the matter. And everybody said, oh, that's all right. August 2nd, 1934, Paul Hindenburg died. Hitler then became president, chancellor, and Führer, and now insisted that officers of the army and the navy, of the military services and the Luftwaffe, take an oath to his person rather than an oath to the state. That was a fateful move which had its final consequences in the attempts of the military to assassinate Hitler in 1942, 43, and 44, where many of them said, no, we would violate our oath. That's contrary to the honor of an officer, the honor of a German. We don't like Hitler. He's awful. We are going down to defeat and everything else, but our oath is the self. It's me. and therefore I cannot violate my oath. It was a very shrewd move on Hitler's part to have them take the oath to his person rather than to the Constitution and to the state. May 7th of 1936 was the breaking of the Versailles Treaty and the march into the Rhineland at a time when Hitler was still quite weak. Germany militarily incapable of the moves that Hitler was making, but he had a shrewd sense that nobody would do anything about it, and he was right. You read the biographies of the great people of this period, Hitler, Chamberlain, and others, Daladier, the collapse of France, and so on, and they thought that they could manipulate Hitler. Many people thought that. In the end, he was the one who knew who was manipulable and how, and got away with literally murder. March 2nd, 1938, Martin Niemöller found innocent in a trial, but nevertheless sent to a concentration camp, a series of them, eventually Dachau, simply because Hitler had the power to do that. Remember, the first thing that happened after the Reichstag fire, I read this on Monday, was the suspension of all normal constitutional guarantees for free press, free speech, the possibility of search and censorship of mail, of everything. Under those laws, Hitler could do what he wanted. It didn't matter that Niemöller was found innocent. He went to concentration camp anyway. March 12, 38, the annexation of Austria. April 20th, 1938, as a birthday present to Hitler, all the pastors of all the German evangelical churches took a personal oath to Hitler as a birthday gift to him. The clergy, oh, one goes on. September 29th, the Munich Agreement and the annexation of the Sudetenland. That was finally the consolidation of Hitler's power, because the Sudetenland, we drove through that this summer. When you go from Prague to Dresden, you drive through that part of Czechoslovakia, which was surrendered to Hitler. It is militarily impregnable. It's just a marvelous country for defense, dreadful country for a military attack. That's what Hitler wanted, you see, because once he got that, then he could move his troops into the Sudetenland, into that hilly, mountainous part of Czechoslovakia that borders on Germany, and he had nothing in front of him but the plain leading to Prague. Britain and France bartered that away, but at that time, Czechoslovakia, Russia, France, Germany, England could have eliminated Hitler quite simply. But in fact, if he had not won the Sudetenland, they would have had help from the military in Germany, as we now know. But of course, the move was not made. Hitler got away with it, and then England and France were simply denuded of any possibility of response. November 9th, 38 now, with all power consolidated in his hands, with the general staff under his control, the dismissal of Werner von Fritsch, and the control of the military in his hands, the enthusiastic support of everyone for his bloodless victories and annexations, he was now able to turn against the Jews. November 9th, 1938, the Kristallnacht, with the burning of the synagogues and the wrecking of Jewish businesses and the die cast for the final solution. March 15th, now the invasion of Czechoslovakia, again bloodless, turning all of Czechoslovakia into the protectorates of Bohemia, Moravia, Slovakia, and September 1939, the invasion of Poland and the war begins. The high point of the war was the defeat of France in 1940, but what I'm interested in particularly is the fate of the churches. Once the war began, there was no possibility any longer of meaningful opposition, public opposition to Hitler. Helmut Gollwitzer has edited a collection of documents called Dying We Live, the testimonies of hundreds of Christian martyrs, Catholic and Protestant, clergy and lay, some eloquent in their simplicity and some eloquent in other ways, people who lost their lives. You go to Munich today, in front of the university is still the plaza or the Platz Geschwister Scholl. Some university students at Munich who distributed anti-Nazi pamphlets were immediately arrested and executed. You couldn't be a conscientious objector in Germany in those days. Hitler simply had everyone beheaded. The opposition was no longer possible. Out of the period leading up to the war and going to 1940 comes this beautiful book of Bonhoeffer's, The Life Together, copies in the bookstore. These are a series of morning devotions that Bonhoeffer had for students in Pomerania, in Finkenwalde, where the Confessing Church had a seminary until it was definitively closed in 1940. The Bureau Grieber, a group of 90 evangelical Christians, operated until 1941, getting Jews out of Germany. They called themselves, I think I mentioned this on Monday already, Evangelische Hilfstelle für Rasseverfolgte, the Evangelical First Aid Station for the racially persecuted, but they were penetrated by the Gestapo and simply rolled up. However, thousands of Jews were able to escape through that. I think it's important for us to recall today the Lutheran and other Christian instances of assistance to Jews. Someone has assembled and documented all of this in a book called The Gray Book, if you can ever get your hands on it, just The Gray Book. Interesting that the country which had a flawless record of support of its Jews was Lutheran Denmark. The country that did second best, you will never guess, so I'm going to tell you, Bulgaria. Don't ever laugh at Bulgaria again. They did a fabulous job of protecting and defending their Jews during the Second World War and lost less than any other country to the Nazis, who were just sweeping them up everywhere they could, transporting them to the East and exterminating them. But also in Germany, many German families risked their own lives and safety to hide Jews, to share food with them during periods when rationing made food scarce in the first place, where they simply hid Jews throughout the war. And I think it's important for us to remember these stories. One of them is the story of Werner Zilten, whose father was Jewish, who died in Dachau in 1942. Zilten lost his pastorate right after the Aryan laws were passed. He worked with the Bureau Grieber until 1941. He often had opportunities himself to escape, but always found more urgent cases, he said. In 1941, with the others, he was sent to Dachau, and there his health... ironic. I mean, notice the ironies here. Outside, he couldn't be a pastor and preach in normal life, you see. But once the Gestapo had put him in Dachau, in the Pfarrerblock, with all of the other pastors and clergy, no restrictions anymore, you see. I mean, in prison, you can preach. Outside, you can't. But in jail, you can. There he was preaching, and his hearers said his sermons had one theme, Die Welt braucht viel, viel Liebe. The world needs much, much love. In 1942, he was last seen in September on an Invalidentransport, where they took the prisoners from Dachau who were no longer fit for hard labor, drove them or took them to Schloss Hartstein, just across the border in Austria. They were gassed and burned, and his ashes were sent to his family with the news that he had died in prison. There is still to this day a photograph of Zilten in the Luther House in Eisenach. One of the interesting things that you see in East Germany today is the streets named after communist martyrs, and the churches have named their buildings and set up photographs to the church's martyrs. Both communism and Christianity suffered grievously under Hitler. There is in Eisenach now a Gemeindehaus for one of the newer parishes, a parish house for one of the newer parishes on the in the outskirts of Eisenach, named the Werner Zilten House, as a way of memorializing this man. On April 9, 1945, Bonhoeffer was hanged at Flossenbürg together with Admiral Canaris, General Oster, and four or five others who were part of the Canaris group that was involved in the conspiracy against Hitler. On April 30th, Hitler committed suicide, and on May 8th, Germany surrendered. One interesting thing that struck me when we were commemorating Hiroshima is how unnecessary the bombing of Japan was at the end. The defense of it always has been, you know, that it saved millions of lives because meant we didn't have to invade Japan. But shortly after Germany's surrender, John Toland has laid this all out in his book, The Rising Sun, Japan sent strong peace feelers to the Allied powers in Geneva in May of 1945. They asked only one condition. This is why in the just war theory, unconditional surrender is not a moral objective for a war. It's one that ought to be resisted, you see, by all people who want to operate under principles, I guess, of justifiable violence. The Japanese asked one condition: that they keep their emperor. It was a condition we later granted anyway, because it made the most sense to deal with Japan in this way. But we rejected that, and there were thus three more months of war, including the dropping of the bombs and a lot of death that was really needless. It's interesting to ask oneself whether, and we will probably never know, whether the real reason for dropping those bombs was to send a signal to Stalin that we had a power which he was not able to match. And it was such a short-lived advantage, about 4 years. What happened to Germany after the collapse, after the Zusammenbruch? First of all, it was a totally devastated society. My landlord in Heidelberg, when I came as a student in 1954, told us how he took almost 3 months to get from Munich, where he had been stationed at the end, to Heidelberg, which is a four-hour train ride. But he traveled by night, did a lot of walking, stayed out of sight, took off his uniform. Nobody wanted to be caught in a uniform. Finally made it to Heidelberg. Postal services breaking down, transportation breaking down, distribution systems, everything. Hard for us to imagine what it is like when a society suffers a total collapse. What happened, of course, was that Germany was divided into four zones of occupation, with the Russians taking over Berlin and the areas around it and to the east. In the churches, a denazification occurred in society generally. The American military government and the other Allied and Russian military government saw to that. In the churches, the German Christians were removed from their positions everywhere, and they were replaced now by the leadership of the confessing church, everywhere except in the so-called intact churches, the churches that were not really involved in the conflict between Deutsches Christentum and the confessing church. These intact churches included Hanover, where Bishop Mararens eventually was succeeded by Hans Lilje, Württemberg, where Bishop Wurm stayed on until his death in 1953, and Bavaria. These were the largest Lutheran territorial churches. In East Germany, the removal of the Deutsche Christen and the replacement of them by Bekennende Kirche people was most far-reaching, because the churches of the old Prussian Union were the ones under communist domination. And of course, the lesson that they drew from Barmen and from the bitter Nazi years was mitigated opposition, militant opposition to totalitarian regimes. They simply said, nothing has changed, communism has replaced Nazism, but nothing has changed, except that now we are in the positions of leadership in the church, and the opposition was intense. My story about all of this goes to the week around May Day of 1955. The Fulbright Commission brought all the German Fulbright students to Berlin for a week. It was a marvelous week. I will still remember it. Berlin was still more destroyed than any other city in Germany because of the distance between West Berlin and Western Germany. You could see whole acres of neatly piled rubble, the streets cleared, the sidewalks cleared, but no buildings standing. And yet Berlin was a vibrant city. There was as yet no wall. You could get on the U-Bahn or the S-Bahn and simply go into the Eastern Zone for the day. Nobody checked anything. There was no checkpoint Charlie, no showing of passports, no delays, nothing. You could just ride back and forth. I spent 4 of the 7 days that we were there wandering around in East Berlin. And on May Day of 1955, which was a Sunday, we went to church in the great Marienkirche in East Berlin. Bishop Otto Debelius was preaching that day. He had been a redoubtable fighter against Nazism. Now he was equally militant against communism. He preached that day on the passage from John 12 about the grain of wheat that falls into the ground and bears fruit, dies and bears fruit. He made mention of the posters outside where communist soldiers were defending the socialist homeland against capitalist dogs with snarling, blood-dripping teeth and dollar bills hung around their necks with ribbons. He said, that way of defending oneself with guns is not Christ's way. He says, we know that it is, that one must die in order to have life, not kill in order to have life. The church was absolutely packed that morning, 4,000 people. They closed the doors about a half hour before the service began because the state regulations were the building could hold no more than so many people. If more were found in the building, it would be an excuse to close the church. The choir sang Bach's cantata, Jesu meine Freude, Jesus' priceless treasure, that morning. Debelius presided at the Eucharist, thousands of people streaming forward to share in the body and blood of Christ. It was a very moving moment. Outside, several hundred yards away, the big May Day parade was going on. I went outside, turned, took pictures of the church, and then moved on to the parade, took pictures of a million people marching in the May Day parades. We had easy access to talk to people in restaurants, but also to talk to people in churches. The churches were trying to demonstrate how communism was as bad as Nazism and were developing catechisms in opposition to communism. Their goal, to keep a single church alive in Germany, especially in Berlin-Brandenburg, not to let the division of the city be a symbol for the division of the churches. Debelius insisted to his retirement that he was bishop of all of Berlin-Brandenburg, not Berlin also, but the Russian zone around it. And the great issue in the election of his successor was whether he would be able to be bishop of Berlin-Brandenburg or only of the eastern part, whether he would be allowed to travel back and forth. They elected Kurt Scharf, who was then Bishop of Berlin-Brandenburg, president of the whole EKID, the Evangelical Kirche in Deutschland, one Germany. But he was again not allowed to travel after the wall went up. The goal of the church at that time was a single Landeskirche, a single territorial church that covered communist and West Berlin, communist Germany and West Berlin, and a single evangelical church for all of Germany. That was, however, not the goal of the communists, as we later saw when the wall went up. And of course, the reaction of the communist government to this militant opposition on the part of the church was predictable. Everything was done to hamstring the work of the church wherever it could. Petty restrictions, the refusal to allow building permits or building materials for the reconstruction of churches. Every attempt made, it was two colossal powers, if you will, in militant opposition with each other. That was the first period. It lasted through the decades of the leadership of those people who had been through Nazism, who thought they had learned the lesson, who now wanted to see what had to be seen, namely, no compromise with totalitarianism under any circumstances. They had been hesitant with Hitler. They were not going to make the same mistake twice. As we all know, the Berlin Wall went up in August of 1981, and more than the wall, 61, what did I say?
16.
No. 20 years slipped by. Well, I'm trying to take them off my life, I guess. No, it was August of 1961 that the wall went up, and more than the wall, that whole gash through Europe that starts at the Baltic and, runs along Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and wherever there is a connection with the West. If you've not been through that, if you've not made your way through all of that, one should do it sometime, just sort of once in your lifetime. It is, the security is massive. No easy way to get through. There are some hard and very risky ways, but no easy way. Checkpoint Charlie, you can see by standing on a raised platform in West Berlin, looking at it. Actually, I've been through this whole business, about four times now, twice in 1980 and once in 83 and once this past summer. It's getting easier. This summer, the guards at the German border were just friendly beyond words and ask about our trip, ask how we found East Germany, ask whether we had a good time, talked with us, joked with us a little bit. In 1980, no jokes. I mean, you sat there in dead seriousness. It was like, you know, don't joke about having a bomb in your luggage when you're going through the airport checkpoints in our country today. There was no joking with them then. In 1984, they were quite relaxed, and there was a lot of good humor and good exchange. What happened within a couple of decades, that is, between 1945 and 1965, was the death or retirement of the leadership of the church that had learned the lessons of Barman. And new leadership came to the fore in both church and state. Walter Ulbricht, the spade-bearded communist head of East Germany, and Otto Debelius, the spade-bearded head of the church in East Germany, both died or retired at roughly the same time. New leadership coming. And a new period begins, maybe sometime in the late 60s, early 70s, a new period of reappraisal. The church leadership, including Albert Schoenherr, who was a pupil of Bonhoeffer's and became bishop of one of the Landeskirchen in East Germany, these people began to say, first of all, communism is going to be around for a while. The possibility of its defeat through a military conflict simply did not seem possible. But more than that, they began to say, communism is not Nazism. Now, how could they say that in the light of the gulags of Russia and the purges of Stalin and all of the dreadful things that we have experienced, the wiping out, the genocide in Cambodia? How could they say that? Well, very interesting and very instructive. They said the goals of communism are good goals, noble goals. Justice, employment, economic stability, economic justice above all, equality, these are good goals. They are goals that we share. Not so with Nazism. The very goals of Nazism were antithetical to the goals that Christianity is up to. Race, blood, power, war, that was not an aberration for Nazism. That was its essence. The defeat of the weak, the enslavement of the unfit, or the destruction of the unfit, the enslavement of the inferior races, that was the goal of Nazism. How could you critique Hitler on the basis of his goals? The more power he got, the more true he was to his own expressed aims and intentions. I mean, you couldn't say to Hitler when he was murdering Jews, that is most un-Nazi. See, it was Nazism at its essence. When Hitler wanted to destroy the epileptics and the mentally retarded, Edna Hong writes about this so beautifully in Bright Valley of Love, that was his goal. Racial superiority, power, only the good, the strong, and the beautiful survive. By good, he didn't mean morally good either. He meant useful, you see. I mean, how could you critique Hitler on the basis of his goals? But for communism to be at war is not true communism. I mean, communism has as one of its goals world peace. Communism has as its goals the way in which the strong help the weak. The way in which the more successful help the less successful, you see. I mean, that's at least part of the Communist Manifesto. Communism has had aberrations. Communism has had many faces, some of which are quite uncommunist. They have to do ideological contortions to link Stalin and Marx, for example. So the East German Christians were saying, the goals of communism, the goals of socialism, are not, by definition, incompatible with the goals and the vision of Christianity. Communism can be critiqued on the basis of its charter. Its charter can be held up to it, and it can be told, you are uncommunist at this point, you see. Now that's an interesting, I think, and a very vital distinction for us to make. Well, at least it was vital for them to make. Secondly, they accepted the goal of the state in East Germany, which was to declare itself a separate state. We had a communist guide in 1983. Her name was Jutta Zinke, a 21-year-old student at the University of Leipzig and a very committed communist. And what she wanted most of all was that we would acknowledge East Germany's right to exist as a separate political entity in the world. In large measure, we have all done that. We have all said, well, okay, it's not what we like, but we'll go along with that as a goal. They stopped attempting to maintain a single church in Berlin, and they stopped attempting to maintain a single church in all of Germany. They were willing to acknowledge separate churches. LWF acknowledges this today. The relationship, the door was open to a new relationship with the state. They said to themselves, we can be a church under socialism, and our role will be critical citizenship. So I entitled this lecture today, The Church as Critic. Critical citizenship, that is, we acknowledge that we are citizens of a socialist state. They don't call themselves communists, they aren't there yet. But we will be critical citizens. That is, we will raise the questions that hold the state accountable to its charter. Now that, of course, did not come overnight. There was opposition to that on the part of both some older Christians, but also on the part of older communist leaders. However, life in the churches began to improve. Membership dropped to about 40% of what it was in 1945. That is today about maybe 40% of the population of East Germany, roughly 7 million people, consider themselves evangelical Christians. Now that's a considerable drop, and it varies from the cities where there is less Christian commitment to the rural areas where there's more. Jan and I met a pastor in Dresden He was there with his confirmation class. One of the most marvelous experiences we had in 1980. We had finished a kind of walking tour of Dresden. We were tired. It was late afternoon. And our guide, pastor in Dresden, said, "Oh, there's a good friend of mine over there, and it looks like he's here with the confirmation class." And they were all dragging and drooping, too. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And all he did was mention the word American, and they shot up as if it were early morning and came roaring over, stood around us, wanted to hear everything about America. We still get postcards from them every year, usually at Easter. And here, our guide said to us, "This is a village where 1,500 of the 1,700 people are still kirchlich. So the overwhelming majority of the village considers itself kirchlich. It's a collective village, you know, farm, agriculture, everything collectivized, but the people remain attached to the church. Membership is now stable and generally quite vital. There are no privileges attached to being kirchlich at all. In fact, you lose privileges. You cannot ever rise to the top positions in anything. Business, government, industry, nothing. You cannot go to university. You are likely not even allowed to complete your full education if you are known to be kirchlich. You have no privileges. So the people who are kirchlich are there because they want to be. And that makes an enormous difference. The church is much more communal, much more liturgical. We were in Eisenach in 1980 on a Sunday when a baptism was celebrated of a baby. It was a bold, I mean, now you can see what infant baptism really means. It doesn't mean getting the baby done to be on the safe side. It was, well, that's what most of us think, you know, today. Well, take the baby out in the cold unless you've had it baptized. Well, there, I mean, these people were making a conscious choice for their child. That meant, we met a woman on a train that told us what this means. We started talking in German, and her little daughter, 6-year-old daughter, was training to be an Olympic swimmer already at age 6. And then she found out that I was a theologian from America, and she laughed a little and sort of embarrassed, and she said, "Yeah, natürlich sind wir nicht kirchlich, naturally we're not churchly." She said, "Little Ursula couldn't have all these advantages of Olympic swimming training if she were kirchlich, you see." Well, so now imagine, you see, what parents are doing when they bring a baby to be baptized. They are making a decision and a commitment that is clearly no privileges. And that's a kind of awesome and wonderful thing. And it was celebrated by that congregation with great joy. Bonhoeffer writes about this in a memo to members of the conspiracy. Now remember, this was under Nazism, but here it applies. "It remains an experience of inestimable value that for once we have learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the excluded, the suspected, the ill-treated, the powerless, the oppressed, the despised, in short, the suffering. If only no bitterness or envy has gnawed at our hearts at such a time, so that we can see the great things and the small, happiness and misery, strength and weakness, with new eyes, so that our perception of the significant, of humanity, justice, and mercy has become clearer, freer, and less corruptible. So that personal suffering becomes a more useful key, a more fruitful principle for viewing and actively understanding the world than simply our own personal happiness. It is only a question of not allowing these perspectives from below to become a prop for eternal dissatisfaction, but instead doing justice to life and giving our assent to it in all its dimensions from a higher contentment which has its true source beyond all concepts of above and below." Bonhoeffer is saying that there is really a perspective that is valid for looking at life, now not to be in charge of anything, and these Germans are not, but to see everything from below. That's the way the church is today. It does its mission in a humble way. You'll notice a little sign on the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. 6 o'clock. 20 minutes of music and meditation. I went to it. Hundreds of people streaming to the church from work. A beautiful little Bach piece played on the organ. Then a man goes to the podium and he says, I'm going to read a piece of ancient literature to you. You will not understand it. It will seem very strange and alien to you, but if you find a word or a phrase that you can seize on, meditate on this for a bit. And then he read a psalm. Instead of standing up and saying, the psalm for today is, you know, I mean, we just take that so for granted. Here he had to give it a little introduction. Ancient literature, you won't understand it, but pick a word or a phrase. Why? Because many of the people were young. They had no encounter with the Bible in their schools and probably not in their homes, but they come to the churches and here they hear this word. I talked to one of them afterwards. I said, why, are you a Christian? Oh, no, he said, bin nicht kirchlich, I'm not kirchlich, don't belong to church. I said, why do you come? Oh, he thought a minute and he said, you know, this is an island of freedom and truth. And he said, it's like emigrating without leaving your country. Ah, I thought to myself, what if people could say that in America? You know, that the church is an island of freedom and truth. Could you think of that? Well, I couldn't. But like emigrating without leaving your country. See, tomorrow we're going to have to ask ourselves, what is happening to us? What is the church like under Western democracy? But today, see, they know. They put up art displays in the Kreuzkirche. Hundreds of people come in and walk around. We saw that in the Georgenkirche in Eisenach, these displays. The seminaries are full of young people today who were not baptized as infants or confirmed as adolescents, but who came to the church like this boy in Leipzig. It's an island of freedom and truth. It's like emigrating without leaving your country. No privileges. Pastors can leave if they want. That's, again, one of the remarkable things. The pastors can emigrate in time. The government will help them out. You know, I mean, they'll say, go, you know, glad to see you go. All the clergy who stay are there because they want to be there. That's wonderful, and they don't have to. And they are with people who don't have privilege. Now, what about the state? Oh, humor goes with all of this. Dan was talking about this in every morning in the Revelations Bible study. The humor of the oppressed, it's wonderful. They tell jokes. Even the communists do this. One Ayuta told us, our communist guide told us, that one of the jokes they tell is two communists meet. One of them says, do you think America could really become communist? And the other one says, well, it's theoretically possible, but a little country like East Germany can't support two great powers. And, you know, I mean, they are under no illusions. They know. Jutta said to me, well, we belong to Russia, and in the West they belong to the USA. It's that simple, you know, for them. But they have good humor, they tell their jokes, they laugh with one another. The state also needs the church. That's the strange thing that's beginning to happen. Communism in East Germany has not been able to inspire a consistently high work ethic. People malinger, they don't really care what they are making, they take every day off that's allowed them, and they get a lot of days off. So the church, the state, is dependent upon Christians with their work ethic. Here, this is an amazing thing. You witness to the gospel by your capacity to do faithful work. You show up every day. You don't take all the days off that are allowed you. You do consistently good work. They couldn't fulfill their five-year plans without a lot of Christians who operate out of a work ethic. They also need money from the West. That's an advantage. And they want to preserve the cultural heritage that is Germany's. Everywhere we went in 1983, Luther posters, right next to it, Marx posters, the 500th anniversary of the birth of Luther, the 100th anniversary of the death of Karl Marx. But they want their cultural heritage. They want to co-opt Hitler. They want to preserve the great buildings. And so it leads to anomalies. The theological faculties are maintained at the universities. They're barely maintained, one professor per subject, and a limited number of students, like 25 students, can enroll at the University of Karl Marx University in Leipzig. But that Karl Marx University has a theological faculty. That's an anomaly. The editor of Evangelische Literaturzeitung, one of the most famous journals of theology in the world, comes out of Leipzig and is a professor at Karl Marx University. But, of course, that's not nearly enough to maintain leadership for the churches, so the church has its own seminaries. I lectured at one of them in Leipzig in 1980. I will go back again as the first, I think the first, American guest professor at the seminary in Leipzig in 1984 and 85 in the spring. The paperwork is still being done, but the state has given its approval for that. Uneasy partnership in the universities, the hospitals. In Dresden, we stayed at the Deaconess Hospital, run by Lutheran deaconesses. The Communist Party officials go there for health care because it's better than in the state hospitals. Again, love. The choir schools, the great Thomas Choir and the great Kreutz Choir, two of the most famous boys' choirs in the world, are supported by the state because they've been around a long time. And so here, the one place where the state teaches religion is in the choir schools, because the kids have to sing primarily for the church services of the Thomaskirche and the Kreuzkirche. In 1980, in anticipation of the Luther anniversary, a Luther Committee was formed of communist and church leaders. It was printed on the front pages of Neues Deutschland, the Communist Party paper, and it occasioned some prominent resignations from the government on the part of communist officials who said, we can't do this, we're betraying our own past and our own history and our own ideology. But the state is saying we got to do this. And they had a good experience in 83. The millions of people came to West Germany, or to East Germany, many of them Americans, and we behaved ourselves, and we didn't try to make propaganda, and we didn't try to denigrate the state. They have such an inferiority feeling. They see Western television everywhere. They know that materially the West is better off. All they want, in many ways, is for us to accept them, not to make fun of them, not to denigrate them. They know that they were stripped by Russia in 1945 and 46. They know they haven't made a comeback. They want our recognition and our support and our respect and not to be laughed at. They have given building permits now, the government, to the churches to restore churches and to restore historical sites. But they have still not permitted any Christian influence on public life in any way. So the church remains a minority where one can have a limited partnership. If one asks the question, can the church live under communism? The answer has to be often far better and more vitally than in West Germany. There are problems, but if they are teaching us anything, it is that new status from established to opposition to critic has meant vitality for the church. I've gone too long this morning. I just had too much to tell you. What do you want to ask about in 3 minutes or less? Or talk about or say anything? Anybody? What? Please, there.
I was wondering, and maybe you touched upon this earlier, at that Barman Synod, did they realize what might be involved cost-wise for them? Imprisonment or punishment or that the future might be repressed?
That's a good question. Probably not fully. I think they still assumed that they were operating roughly within the framework of the Germany that they had grown up in, with laws and due process and everything else. I think the Rheim assassination and purge, which came 5 weeks after Barman, that was what revealed to everybody what was in store. Now, I want to add to that. I think once they did find out, they continued to be confessors. So they may not have fully known at Barman, but when they did find out, it didn't inhibit their confession.
What do you see as the future of the church like in East Germany, as critic?
Well,
I know that, you know, there's got to be a conflict that develops.
Probably not. I'm really quite optimistic about the future. The relationships between the two Germanies are improving steadily. While we were over there this summer, West Germany announced loans of billions of marks to East Germany. They are the ties between the two are increasing, the economic ties, the cultural ties. The Honecker, the head of East Germany, is going to pay a state visit to the West. It'll be the first time that's happened since the end of the war. I talked about the friendliness of the guards. And the church, really, as I said, its membership is now stable. And it will continue to be a vital place in East German society. I think the reason why it's so important is because East Germany has the only really sizable Protestant church behind the Iron Curtain. There are other Protestant churches. They're not as big. The Catholic churches have already demonstrated that they're going to do all right. It'll be difficult. Poland is an example, but they will make it. In some countries, Vietnam, for example, the church has actually grown. It's four times as large as it was, let's say, in 1950. So I'm fairly optimistic. I don't think communism will destroy the church. I would say that on principle, even if there weren't evidence to support it. Dan, we didn't get around to China. Are you going to do that tomorrow night?
I'll show slides Thursday during between the two dinners.
Between the dinners. Okay, 5:30 or so tomorrow evening. Comment there, first of all.
Yeah, just wanted to underscore one thing that you said about that student or young fellow in St. Thomas Kirk. When we were worshiping in Leipzig in the other big church, St. Nicholas.
Nikolai, yeah.
The pastor there kind of underscored what you said, and his word was that God is stronger than Karl Marx.
Of course.
And that this kind of instance just underscores it.
But the relationship, I think, is an interesting one. It's not we're going to win, we're going to beat you. Mm-hmm. It's that we can live in a state which has this as its form. We can do it indefinitely. One of the most dramatic things I experienced this summer, Joan Holt asked me what was the most important thing that happened since we've seen each other in 5 years, and it didn't take me very long to identify. We were in the Augustinian cloister this summer, for a church service at 8:30 in the morning on Sunday morning. They have an early service and they have a late service. But the late service was going to be church dedication. And everybody was at it, so there were about 25 Americans and 5 Germans at 8:30. And the pastor came to me. He had met us at the door. First of all, none of this greeting and when it's all over. It's too late then. They greet people when they come. Wonderful custom. I commend it to every church in America. Greet people when they arrive. So he met us when we came. He came out then and he said to me, we have more Americans than Germans here this morning. Will you translate? So I did, the lessons and the prayers and the sermon. And in the end, he ended up preaching to me so I could preach to the congregation. It was great. And his sermon was on the parable of the kingdom of God and the workers in the vineyard. And what he did was to say, the kingdom of God is not the exclusive possession of the church. The kingdom of God is happening in a lot of places. It's also happening in the state. Wherever there is economic justice, they have no unemployment. Wherever there is quest for peace, there the kingdom of God is happening. So it was a wonderful sermon. And it was a way of encouraging these people to think that the kingdom of God is bigger than the church, but it is also being witnessed to by the church. And it was a great and high moment for all of us to be part of that service of worship in which they were, in a sense, I think what I'm trying to say here is getting ready for the long haul, how to be the church in a hostile environment. Dan is talking about that. We ought to be encouraged by our own roots in the Bible, in the New Testament. I mean, they were church in a hostile environment, too, and made it, you see. So, end of the day today. Or do you want to have the last word?
Just where is the prophetic voice in East Germany right now for the churches?
Might take time.
Yeah.
Critic is a different way of being than Barman.
Yeah.
Okay. See you tomorrow.